Good afternoon. So, yeah. So hopefully you're here for 4414. So I'll start by going over some logistics briefly, and then I'm going to go right into course material. So first, there's a course webpage. It's linked off Colab. You can hopefully find it. There's a URL here, but it's linked off Colab, so you don't need to like frantically write that down. This course will have homework assignments. They are programming assignments. They are worth 55% of the grade, so I suggest you pay attention to them. First is due next week, and is relatively simple, sort of an introduction. Most of the programming assignments will be in C or C++. I know for some of you, it's been a while, and you might want to keep that in mind. There will be one at the end that will probably be in Python. Each assignment will give you 1 or 2 weeks. If it's 2 weeks, there will be a checkpoint submission in the middle. 2 week assignments will be worth more. So please do not take them as an assignment which is the same as the others. You can just start it 3 days before the deadline. Don't do that. Also, don't try to start all the assignments 3 days before the deadline, probably. A bunch of the assignments are going to use XV6, which is a teaching operating system. And this is a real operating system that you should be able to boot on some real X86 machine, though we'll be running it in an emulator. Based on an old version of Unix, Unix version 6, that's the name, that was developed at some people at MIT, which they used to use for their own OS course. They now have a version of it for a different processor, but I'm going to use that for a bunch of assignments. And some of the other assignments will be on a Linux-like environment instead. In addition to homeworks, we're going to have quizzes. There will be online quizzes after each week of lecture on things we talked about in lecture. First will be this week. I will talk about how you do them next time. And it will have the same interface as 3330. If you took it with me, I'll show you otherwise. There's no time limit. And they're open book, open notes, open internet. But please don't like work on it with someone else, or like call up your friend, or copy the question to Stack Overflow, etc. There will be exams, a midterm, and a final. If you can't make the midterm, let us know soon, or else it will be bad. There is a combined final for both sections, which is at a special time, not at the time for this course slot. It's on the final schedule, but many people don't look at the bottom part. If you can't make that, you should let me know at some point. We can find, like, if it's you can't make it because you have another final at the time, we can definitely accommodate that. If it's something else, you should talk. Also, since I mentioned homeworks, there is a late policy on the website. I'm not going to go over it in lecture, but you should read it if you care. Talk about textbooks. There is no required textbook. There is a recommended textbook, which is this, Operating Systems Principles and Practice by Anderson and Dahlin. And I also suggest this textbook, Operating Systems, Three Easy Pieces by Arpeche Dasu, husband and wife. This textbook has free PDFs legitimately available from the authors. I suggest the other textbook partly because you can get this if you change your mind, and partly because this is a little terse for some of the things we talk about. At least in my opinion, you might disagree. And on, so I mentioned on quizzes, they're open book, open notes, and internet. We're going to talk a little about cheating, where homeworks are the main concern. Homeworks are individual assignments. They are not partners. They are not group projects. You may not use code from prior semesters, except if you have the unlucky situation of taking this class again after signing up for it in the prior semester. That's fine. You may not share code, pseudocode, or detailed descriptions of code. Like, I should not look at this and say you must have working from like the same exact pseudocode and just figured it out. You can talk generally, but like not at that level of detail, please. And no using code from the internet or so on, with limited exceptions. So I don't want this to be a class where if you like need to split up a string, that you're going to have to code that yourself, because that's not what this class is about. So for things which are clearly not the point of the homework in question, you can use code. It must be credited where it is used. If I read your source code and I see like a split string function that is not your code, I better know where it comes from. So you can use a small amount of code that's clearly not the point of the assignment. So like splitting a string into an array for an assignment where the main goal is not text parsing, which will be assignments in this class, or filling an array of pointers from a vector of strings, like a C++ thing you might need to do at some point. Like things like that, I'm okay. If you're not sure if it counts, you should ask us. If it's part of the major objective of the assignment, please don't do it. So for example, we have an assignment to write a shell. We'll talk about what a shell is later. You probably shouldn't be cribbing code from another shell to do that. You know, that's probably a bad sign, even if the code you take is not the main part of it. And on the quizzes, I mentioned, like, they're individual, don't share answers, don't IM people, don't ask on Stack Overflow for answers, but we expect you to use your notes, review lectures, and so on, and they're untimed. Like, it's intended to get you to actually review the material. And a note about wait lists. If you need this course, like now, this semester, to graduate on time, and you're on the wait list, email me with specifics, including which sections you can register for. And if you are going to say you can't register for both, you should please explain. And I will figure something out. We have limited space in rooms, so I probably can't like take absolutely everybody, though there will probably be enough drops that most people in the waitlist will get in anyways. We need 1 or 2% churn, you know, to get a lot of them in. So, but you know, I understand some of you are nervous about that. On getting help, so we're gonna have Piazza, office hours, both TA office hours and my, which will be posted on the website soon. I have some tentative ones on the calendar there, but I might need to change them because I have meetings yet to be scheduled for the semester. Or you can email me. So any questions about logistics before I just dive into actually talking about operating systems? Yes? The homework, so on the website, there is a schedule tab, and that and also an assignments tab, which has the information about when every assignment is due, along with links to the write-up for the first homework and write-ups which might be changed for the later homeworks. Basically, the homeworks are generally, homeworks and checkpoints are generally due Friday at 11:59 p.m. That schedule is mainly because I don't want to feel obliged to promptly answer questions on the weekend. And don't want my TAs to feel obliged to promptly answer questions on Saturdays and Sundays. And if I had them due on like Saturday at midnight, I'm sure that would be the peak time for questions. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk about operating systems, and first thing we need to say is what does it mean for something to be an operating system? So one way you could look at this is you could look up at the history of what is a computer operator, and there used to be a job called computer operator. There were some computer operators from the 60s, 70s, and they were responsible for like loading programs, getting the data in, all sorts of things that we kind of have software to take care of now that our computers don't have giant tapes that you have to load manually for each program and so on. Now, I'm going to try to give like a couple sort of vague definitions of operating system, but we're not actually going to have a precise one. Like, it's kind of replacing this sort of manual task of making your computer work that these ladies may have been doing. But there's some ambiguity. And the ambiguity is that there's some things which some people will say, that's part of the operating system. And someone will say, that's just a program that that you're running, or just a library. It's not actually part of the operating system. It's this other thing. And one example, for example, is that we'll see is that, like, on my machine, I can move Windows around. Is the code that does that part of the OS? And the answer depends on who you ask. Some people will say, yeah, of course it is. That's part of, like, managing multiple programs. That's, like, sort of an administrative thing. That's not really an operating system thing. And some people will say, no. That's just something that's running. That's just a program you're running which shows Windows. We're going to give common principles. We're not going to dive deeply into these debates on what exactly counts. We're going to give, like, sort of the high-level view of these are things that are operating system-like, but we're not going to ask you, is this part of the operating system for most things? Because often the answer is maybe. So have sort of approximate definitions from two textbooks. So software that manages a computer's resources, that's one definition of what the operating system is. So what are resources? We have like the processor, we have memory, we have disks, we have devices that you can read input from or write output to, like network. So that's one definition, is the operating system, the software that manages that. Another definition from Kenshi SO is that the operating system is software that provides a virtual machine for programs to use that's more convenient than the real machine. We'll talk about what that means a little more. So managing is a word which can mean a lot of things, and Anderson Dahlin tries to break this down. And they say that as part of managing the resources, operating systems do these three categories of things. So one category they give is they call the role of a referee, that there's multiple things that want to use these resources, and the operating system's responsible for arbitrating between them. So this handles resource sharing and also protection, meaning that, you know, my memory is different than another program's memory. And isolation, that I don't have to worry about, are there 10 things running on the CPU or 20? I write the same program, it still works. Talk about the illusionist view, that part of managing those resources is going to be providing a better interface to them. So providing these abstractions that are clean and easy. And why do we say clean and easy? Because the implication is that the thing they're abstracting is not clean and easy. That hardware is messy, and the operating system's job is to make that problem go away. That the operating system interface should not be messy. Of course, whether operating systems actually succeed at this, sometimes. And they also have this third role of glue, of providing common services, things that lots of programs need, that we can have one implementation of. And this is a case where you'll get people disagreeing about whether this is part of the operating system, because it's not as core, even though you probably think of many of these services as really important, like storage, like managing directories. Probably think of that as like really important to your computer being useful, but you know, that isn't like a part of abstracting the disk necessarily, or windowing systems, networking, and so on. So with all of these views, the OS is abstracting the hardware to do some extra work. So we can think of, we have these applications that sit on top of the operating system, and the operating system sits on top of the hardware. And a consequence of this, and this gives us to our other definition, the one that Apache.Suse of this virtual machine is that as far as application one is concerned, if it wants to figure out what the hardware is, conceptually, it has to go through the operating system for that. It doesn't actually ever observe the hardware directly. All it sees is what the operating system provides to it. This is conceptually because we'll find out that in reality, well, parts of the application are using the hardware directly and parts aren't. But conceptually, the operating system is choosing what the application sees. So rather than being written for a particular piece of hardware, the application's written for a particular operating system and what it provides. So this gives the idea of a virtual machine interface, that we have this layering, and we can say that what's between the operating system and the hardware is this physical machine interface. What's between the operating system and the application is a virtual machine interface. Now, when I talk about virtual machines in this way, many of you are probably thinking, like, wait a moment, I know what a virtual machine is. That's like VirtualBox, VMware, Parallels. Those are things for running operating systems on other operating systems. Now you're telling me, like, applications, like my web browser is running in a virtual machine. So there's this spectrum. And we can think of this virtual machine interface as something the operating system chooses, and there's a variety of choices the operating system can make. And what we're used to calling an operating system are this virtual machine interface, which is chosen for the convenience of applications. And this is often known as a process virtual machine because it provides the process abstraction, we'll talk about what that means a bit later, rather than trying to imitate something else. So this is chosen to make it easy to write applications, and we're less concerned about how close it is to the hardware. And the things you've called virtual machines are implementations of what we'll call a system virtual machine, where the goal of the choice there is to imitate physical hardware. Maybe not the physical hardware we're running on, but some physical hardware. Because often we want to run something that expects to run on physical hardware directly with a system virtual machine. With a process virtual machine, our program is not going to expect any particular set of physical hardware and not going to be written for that. Instead, we're going to choose interfaces that are going to do things we can only do without having physical hardware directly. So one example is files. Like a hard drive or a thumbstick or an SSD doesn't actually have directories. But when we're writing applications with this process virtual machine, we can refer to directories and files because that's part of the more convenient interface the operating system has chosen. But something like VirtualBox, when it's running some operating system in that virtual machine, it doesn't provide files, it provides a virtual disk, which is not a more convenient interface. It's imitating real hardware. So it's a different goal. So questions about this distinction? Okay. So our process virtual machine is going to have analogs towards the real hardware that sort of provide the same functionality but have a very different interface. So for example, we're going to talk about threads. And a thread is basically an abstraction of a processor. And because it's an abstraction, it's going to be able to do some things that our real processors can have. And one thing is that you can have many, many threads, even if you don't have many physical CPUs. With the processor, you know, if we have four processors, or four cores, that is, by processor I mean say this is equals core. So if we have four cores, you're not going to magically get more. But with threads, we'll just have as many as we want, basically up to how much memory you have. because they're an abstraction. They're not real processors. They just look kind of like processors. They have their own set of registers. They seem to run as long as we need to run until we stop using them, and so on. In our process VM, we're going to be able to like malloc memory and things like that. But in the real hardware, we're going to have some fixed amount of actual memory, and we're going to set up how we access that with page tables. So that's the page tables are this hardware feature, but the operating system is going to expose this more convenient interface of memory allocation, so we can do things like malloc and free rather than actually deal directly with what's the physical address that we're setting up, where is it located, and so on. So we're going to have files. And by a file, I mean something which we can open, then read or write, and then close. And this is how we're going to abstract all our devices. And by devices, I don't just mean like hard drives and solid state disks. I also mean like the keyboard, the screen, and so on. We're going to have this one interface that's going to be a way of accessing all these devices, even though the hardware underneath has a lot of details that are specific to the kind of device we're talking to, that we have to do something very different for the write operation to a hard drive than to display something on a screen. We have to do something very different for reading from a hard drive and reading from the keyboard or reading from the network internally. But the operating system's just going to provide us one interface where we said, write this stuff there, you know, this text to the screen or to the file or to the network, and the operating system will handle all the details, even though they're different depending on the kind of thing that's behind our file abstraction. Okay. So we can view this as, now we have sort of our expanded view of our process virtual machine. We have these threads, we'll call address spaces, that memory allocation abstraction processes we'll talk about later, file sockets, these high-level abstractions. And the operating system's goal here is to translate that to these lower-level things that the hardware provides of interrupts, memory addresses, special registers, devices, I/O buses, all the hardware details, many of which we'll talk about later. And the reason we call this a virtual machine is the application's machine is the operating system. That's all the application knows about. And we usually think this is a good thing. This is why I can, part of why I can often take a very old program and run it on a much more recent machine, is because the old program is not written to talk directly to my display, which, you know, is very different in 2019 than it was in like 1990. It's written to talk to the operating system, which has provided this stable, simpler interface. And also, this is more featureful than real hardware. Like, we have threads, we can have as many as we want, we don't have to worry about how many cores do we actually have, we can have lots of files, we don't have to worry about how do I partition this disk into segments. The OS has that extra features for us. And in this view, the operating system is translating one interface to another. So let's talk about some examples here. So if we have an application, we're going to represent an application in the operating system with something we're going to call a process. And what a process is going to have is it's going to represent the program's active registers, which we can call this sort of here. This is the thread information, and also its memory. So the process is just the combination of a thread, one or more threads, and the memory a program can use. That together, along with other things the program can access, that's what we're going to have a process. We'll be much more specific about that with the example of what is XV6 call a process later. And so the operating system is providing this, I have a program that's running, and a running program is called a process, and it's mapping that to actually placing it on the CPU, using the CPU's registers, using some memory to store the data for the program, handles that mapping. And we can have multiple processes. And because we have this abstraction layer, one very important thing we can do is that we can have, say, only one core here, and the process, application one's process, can be have its registers on the CPU, and application two's can have its registers temporarily stored in memory. And this is an advantage of having the abstraction of processes and threads, is that because we have this abstraction, we don't need to put your current stack pointer and value of the return value register and so on the actual CPU registers. We can store it somewhere else and still provide the same interface. And of course, we need to eventually run process one and two. And so we'll do what's known as a context switch and move application two's registers to the CPU and save application one's registers into memory. Yes? So the question is, do these three boxes represent the stack? No, these boxes here are meant to represent registers. And this is meant to represent all the memory of the process, which would include the stack, the heap, the code, and so on. And the reason why you would know that that doesn't represent the stack is because we don't actually put the stack directly on the CPU, on the core. You know, part of it might be cached there, but the master copy is in memory. Is that a question? Other questions? Okay. So we also have an output. So I mentioned we're going to use files. And our files are going to abstract every sort of thing we might talk to. So all those sorts of devices. So another thing I kind of glossed over as far as managing devices is that since we're managing resources, we also manage what happens if applications misbehave. So one example is, let's say, application tries to access memory that's not its memory. Well, then we're going to get a segmentation fault. And this is actually the operating system translating something the hardware did into something more convenient. Now, you might not say segmentation faults aren't convenient, and they aren't, but what the hardware would do otherwise is probably less convenient. You know, the hardware, if the hardware just let you access some random piece of memory or decided to go into an infinite loop, you know, that would be less convenient. So the operating system is still doing something more convenient when we access memory we're not supposed to. Okay. So I talked about process. So we have the thread and address space. And we'll also talk about, you know, some other things. You know, plus, you know, open files. So there might be some other things we'll call part of a process. But the key idea is that the process is this illusion of a dedicated machine. So each of the threads we have in a process is sort of an illusion of a CPU that's just for this application, even though the implementation might be that you share it with some other process and that's handled by the operating system without you really controlling it. And the address space is the illusion of your own memory, but actually you just got a part of the real memory and the operating system makes sure that that's all you get to use. Okay. So one of the key things that this segmentation fault concept gives us is that a big thing that operating systems do is provide protection. That a lot of what we want to do is run multiple applications, and it's not enough that we provide more convenient interfaces for the applications. We also want to protect the applications from each other and protect the OS from the applications doing bad things. So, for example, we would really like it to be the case that I can't write a program that just crashes my operating system and then I can't do anything with my machine. That's a goal of operating systems, is to make that not possible. We also generally like it to be the case that two applications, especially if they're running for different users, like if I log into portal.cs.virginia.edu and you log into that, that I can't write a program that crashes your program. That would be very inconvenient and also sort of make it very hard to share machines between multiple users. So that's a big goal, is that we want to protect the applications from each other. So we want to keep them from crashing each other, and we even want to handle malicious cases. So crashing, you know, typically is I wrote a buggy program, but we also want to handle the cases where, you know, I'm malicious and I'm trying to mess up your program deliberately, maybe in some way more subtle than crashing, and I'm doing things that are really strange to do that. You know, things that aren't part of the normal things programs would do. So to support this, there are two key hardware features that exist only to help out operating systems that operating systems are going to exploit. So these two mechanisms, so one is dual mode operation. So typical processors have two modes they can run in, possibly more than two. One I'm going to call kernel mode. If you read processor manuals, you might see like 25 other names, but we'll use the name kernel mode. And another is called user mode. And the idea is that some operations in the processor are going to require kernel mode. And part of the reason for doing this is that the operating system needs to set up certain things, like access to devices, for example. And we want to make sure only the operating system does that, and that an application that's buggy doesn't accidentally like set up the disk incorrectly and make it so we can't use the disk anymore. And a way we can do that is you can make it so you need kernel mode to set up the disk. So if you don't have kernel mode, you can't do that. And to make this work, the operating system is going to control what code runs in kernel mode. So we're going to start the processor in kernel mode, most likely, and from then on, the OS is going to decide what gets to run in kernel mode. The way it's going to do that is that it's going to control all the ways of entering kernel mode. It's going to write all that code. So all the code which would start running in kernel mode from user mode is going to be the operating system's code. And because it's the operating system's code, the operating system can make sure it only does good things, hopefully. So the second big mechanism is address translation. That we don't want a program that's running to be able to, say, edit the code of the operating system. Now, one way we could do this is we could say, okay, we're just going to tell programs that some part of the memory is for the operating system, and we're going to make it so that memory is only accessible in kernel mode. And this is a choice that some processors make, but we're going to do something a little more complicated because we also want to support running two programs at the same time and protecting them from each other. And to do that, we need to make sure that even though those two programs are both running in user mode, they can't interfere with each other's memory. They can't, like, edit the other program's stack either on purpose or by accident, like they have a dangling pointer. Oops. So the way we're going to do this is with address translation. Our processor is going to let the operating system set a mapping that determines how addresses the program uses are interpreted going to real memory. And because we can set up this mapping so that program A has no way of getting to, say, program B's code or program B's data, there's no way that the two programs are going to interfere with each other. Okay. And you may have seen in prior classes that this mapping on modern machines is typically a page table, and we'll talk about that a lot later in several weeks. Yes?
Is the mapping unique to each program?
Question, is the mapping unique to each program? If they're different processes, yes. So because most notably, like, if you're sharing that same mapping, that means you have the same memory you can access. You're probably part of the same program. It's not strictly required, but it's very likely. It's likely that if we have two things running with the same mapping, they're different threads that are part of the same process. Okay, other questions? So I mentioned these two dual mode operation, kernel mode versus user mode, and address translation. And I said page tables are the modern way we do it. There are some others. These are not the only way of writing operating systems. There are other ways of getting the same functionality, but this is the dominant way modern, like every modern operating system you can think of works. So that's what we're going to be talking about in this course, even though there are other plausible implementations, possibly even faster implementations. We're going to be using these pieces of hardware support. So there's another piece of hardware support that we're going to use, and this is to solve a problem that the operating system has, which is that the OS needs to respond to these events while something else is running. So I press a key while some other program is running. The operating system needs to eventually handle that and figure out what to do with it. And the key press might need to go to a program which is not currently active. Like, it might be, you know, I might have my terminal in the foreground and the web browser is using lots of CPU showing me some pretty pictures in the background. I want the key press to go to that terminal. So the OS needs to run to do that because the OS is the only thing which is able to start the terminal program. Or if a program is using the CPU for too long, we'd really like it to be the case that, you know, if I write an infinite loop by accident, that it doesn't actually run forever without other things being able to say stop it or run at the same time. So we need the OS to run, and the hardware has support to help the OS out with this, known as an exception. You may have seen some other terms for these things, interrupts, or traps, or faults. These are all things that are in the same category, and I'd like to say each of them has a precise definition, but they don't. They usually have a precise definition in any one context. I will try to use the word exception, or interrupt generally, but we'll see all of them used. And XV6, unfortunately, mostly uses the word trap for every type of exception. And the x86 processor manuals mostly use the word interrupt. So it turns out you'll see both of those terms in XV6 for every type of way where the hardware just runs the CPU, runs the OS on the CPU, even though it was previously running application instructions. And exceptions are an important part of dual mode operation. We're going to have this rule for all our operating systems that user code always, always, always runs in user mode. No exceptions. You may have heard of root or administrator or system or various privileged ways of running things or sudo on Linux. Still user mode. No exceptions. And only OS code gets to run in kernel mode. And the exception is how the hardware is going to change from user to kernel mode. And this is, in fact, going to be the only way the hardware will go from user to kernel mode. So if we have anything which needs to run in kernel mode, the OS is going to do that. So one thing we need exceptions for are kernel services. So for example, if I want to allocate memory, that means I need to change the address translation, change the mapping we saw earlier. That's going to require kernel mode because we don't just allow any program to let itself access any memory. That would defeat a lot of the purpose of having that mapping. We want to read and write to a file. We're not going to do that directly. The OS is going to be responsible for figuring out how that works, making sure that it doesn't interfere with other things which are trying to read or write things on the same disk, and it'll all work. Once you read input from the keyboard, the OS is responsible for that. The OS knows what program input goes to and so on. So all these need privileged instructions. So even though these aren't events, we need some way of running code in kernel mode to handle these cases, even though for something like allocating memory especially, like there's no external event that means we have to allocate memory. It's just because the program is running, it needs more memory. But because our exceptions are the only way to go into kernel mode, we're going to use an exception to do that. So we're going to have deliberate exceptions. And to support this, the hardware will usually provide instructions that specifically exist only to trigger an exception. It's the only thing the instruction does, it's all it's for, is triggering an exception. The hardware will handle this like a normal exception, so the same way as a key press, except it's triggered by a specific instruction. And this is how the program is going to request these operations. So the program can't actually run the code which allocates additional memory. It's going to request the OS do that for it. Okay, so questions on this idea? Yes?
Isn't trap usually used to refer to instructions that trigger exceptions?
The question, is the term trap usually used for this? Yes. So trap is the most common term for this. Yeah, this kind of exception. As I said, the terms are all over the place. And XV6 internally uses trap to refer to all the kinds of exceptions, which is confusing. So I'll just say deliberately triggered exception. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at how this might look on typical something like 64-bit x86 and with assembly here. So in Linux, the way these system calls work is that there's a bunch of different system calls. So here we're doing a write operation, which writes to a file. So we put in RAX, the identifier for the system call we want. We say the file we want to write to is standard out. This is the identifier for standard out. That's going to just be a constant. We put the address of what we want to write and how big it is in two other registers. And then we use this special exception triggering instruction, which is called syscall, because it's a system call. It's an operating system call. Kind of like a function call, except we're calling the operating system. We don't actually know where anything is in the operating system. So that's why we have this different convention. And on Linux, what they've chosen is that you just set up a few registers, and wherever that syscall instruction ends up executing is going to read those registers and figure out what you meant. So we execute this special instruction, and there's code the kernel set up previously. And the hardware knows about this because during boot, the kernel set a pointer to that code to tell the hardware, hey, when the syscall instruction happens, go here. And because that pointer was set up, this handler can run, and it can read the registers and figure out what did the program want to do and make that happen. And it can also set the registers before it returns, and then the program can check, you know, was the write successful or not based on that. And you see these particular registers used. Because this is just assembly code, this is just a calling convention. So Linux has chosen this particular calling convention for their system calls, kind of like a calling convention for functions. And that's a choice they made, and other operating systems can make different choices. In fact, in XV6, we'll see a different calling convention for system calls. So when this runs, we have the code on the left side runs in user mode. So all those privileged operations, like things which might actually display something on the screen, are prohibited. And the other side runs in kernel mode where those operations are allowed. And that's the whole reason we needed a system call to do this operation. You also notice that in addition to having a special instruction to start the system call handler here, to run the OS, we have a special instruction to leave it. In x86, it's the iret for return from interrupt. And the reason we need that is because a normal return wouldn't go back to user mode. And we need to go back to user mode. Okay. Questions? Yes?
Do we have to save the registers ourselves before calling the system call, or does it do that all for us?
The question is, what registers need to be saved before we do the system call? And that's a part of the calling convention. So it's something that the operating system is going to have to choose what registers you need to save or not. And the way it's going to reflect that choice is whether the code here saves those registers for you or not. Okay, other questions? Good. Okay, so we have these system calls to access these operating system features. And we have code which services those system calls and also handles things like key presses and other external events that runs in kernel mode. And some people would say that, you know, that's the OS. And this here is the kernel. So the kernel is all the stuff that runs in kernel mode. And we access the kernel using the system call interface. Now, there's some stuff which is on top of the kernel, which I've labeled here as standard libraries and utility programs that we typically see. And typically, we don't actually make system calls directly. Instead, we make library function calls. So for example, on Unix-like systems, and this is showing the Unix design, there's a library, there's the C standard library, libc, which provides functions which call system calls themselves. But that's typically what you end up calling. You don't actually call a system call directly. You don't ever write a syscall instruction in your program. You typically call this library, and the library is implemented using system calls. And some people would say this whole thing here is the OS. So the actual interface the OS provides, the actual virtual machine, some people would say is the one from that library's point of view. Some other people would say it's the system call interface because you could swap out the library conceptually, even though almost no one does that. You could use a different one, but people almost never do. Now, we're going to mostly be talking about this part of the operating system, the stuff that's implemented in the kernel that runs with the special privileges and that handles this system call interface. We'll talk a little bit about some of the stuff up here. In particular, we'd have an assignment about the shell, which is an example of something which uses this lower level interface. But when you're writing typical programs, you don't actually use system calls directly. You typically use libraries to use them. Okay. So we're going to be using XV6. And the reason I showed you this diagram is because XV6 is based on Unix. And it uses the Unix-style design. So it has a kernel with all these sort of lots of these features and a system call interface. And it has this little standard library that is what applications for XV6 are written in. And it's based on 6th edition Unix. So 6th edition Unix ran on a machine called the PDP-11. So this is a rewrite based on that. The reason they use 6th edition Unix is that there is a book with a copy of the 6th edition Unix source code. No, I am not kidding. There's an actual book, I have it in my office, of the 6th edition Unix source code, which was commonly used to study. And originally at MIT, they used that book for their OS course, and then decided sometime in the 90s that, you know, maybe PDP-11 is getting a little outdated, and they should have something that, you know, possibly runs on a machine made in the past several years. And they also, at the time, implemented multi-core, which we mostly won't be taking advantage of, but it is supported in XP6, which wasn't a concern in the original PDP 11. So the first assignment, the one which is due a week from Friday, is adding two system calls to XP6. And we'll talk more about how XP6 handles system calls and so on. But also, of course, as a prereq to do this, you're going to need to download XP6 and get it working. So to get XP6 working, you're going to need a Linux environment, probably. So we supply a VM that works. You can get your own. You should also get department lab accounts, which I need to do. But we don't have that set up yet. You'll get lab accounts, which will be useful for later assignments, XP6 assignments. Sorry, you can't do it on the department machines for reasons of not being able to run the emulator there. And you'll need a copy of QEMU, which is an emulator we'll be using. So it's kind of like VirtualBox, except a little lower level, and it's what XP6 is designed to work in. It also supports things which might be handy that VirtualBox doesn't support well, like you can run GDB on it, which could be useful. People in the past have had success getting XP6 working in OS X, but this is not going to be officially supported by the core staff. And to get it working on OS X, you will need a cross-compiler. And you'll need, or to figure out what a cross-compiler is, and then you'll need a cross-compiler. So we support getting it working in Linux, so because we know that that works, but we understand if you want to have it working more natively, and that is possible, just not, you know, not something we're going to spend time and office hours figuring out with you. Okay, so XP6 has a Unix-like kernel, and it has a very small set of system calls. Now, you might look at the actual list of system calls, which has like around 25, and say, that's not very small, but I assure you it is very small. Typical, like Linux, is probably several hundred system calls. I've heard rumors that Windows is like 1,000. It also has a user space library, which wraps the system calls and provides some functionality built on top of the system calls, and a small set of user space programs. So it has a command line program, so you can run commands, ls, make directory, echo, cat, and some self-testing programs. So let's go through one example. So set it like it's OS. So here's echo. Here's the echo program. Here's the entire source code to the echo program. So this is kind of like a normal C program, but some things are different. So one thing you might notice is the header files are different than what you're used to. There's no standard io.h here. Our printf, that's a little weird. So the printf takes what is called a file descriptor. We'll talk about what file descriptors are later. Important thing is one is output, standard normal output. And in this case, this program is outputting all its arguments followed by a new line. Also, you notice that we don't end main with a return. It ends with a call to exit, which takes no arguments. This is a C function which calls a system call. And why do we need to call a system call to exit? Why would returning, what would be wrong with just returning from main? Why would this work sometimes work on like Linux and not work on XP6? What might be different? So I said system calls are for doing privileged operations. So what's privileged about exiting a program? Why is that not something that the program can do itself in user mode? Yeah?
It's because return calls ret instead of iret in like assembly.
So you're saying, is it because of ret versus iret? Well, so you're worried about we'd have to go back to user mode? We're already in user mode. That's the main difference between ret and iret. But it is something about where we return to. Yeah?
Is it because echo is called in a shell? Or
So echo is called in the shell. You're saying it's that part of it. So it is called in the shell. What should happen after echo finishes running?
Return control to the shell.
So return control to the shell, yes.
Yeah.
So the shell is a different process with a different memory mapping. And remember, we had this protection that we protected programs from each other, so echo can't crash the shell. And the way we did that is they can't access each other's memory. So echo has no way of returning actually to the shell directly. It has to have the OS help it with that. So that's why we need a system call to exit the program. We need a system call to say, hey, I'm done, run a different program. And that to do that, we're going to have to change the apping that's active, load that program's registers, and so on. All this stuff which is going to require the kernel mode operations. Yeah?
So in modern Linux, does the OS take care of all that for you?
So the question is, why on modern Linux do I just use a return instead? Does the OS take care of it? So what happens on a typical Unix-like operating system is that main is not actually the first function that runs. There's another function which runs, calls main, and when you return to it, it makes a system call. So on Linux, there's also an exit system call that handles this, but there's code the compiler provides for you that calls main, that when main returns, calls that system call. Since XV6 is simpler, it doesn't provide that code. In fact, main is where the program actually starts. But that means that you can't actually return from it directly. You need to handle that yourself. Okay. Questions? Okay, so I'll do a brief demo of XV6. So we have some instructions for downloading XV6, and you need to download it via cloning a Git repository, and you'll get a directory something like this. So there's a bunch of C, H, and .s files in a make file. And you can run make. And that should compile everything. And then you can run, I'll use make qemu no x for no graphics. There's also a graphics version, but it won't show up so well in the demo. And that still had some things to compile. And that gives me shell. So we see here that it started running here. This is the command to run the emulator. And this is part of messages that XV6 wrote out when it was booting and starting our initial command line prompt, which is called, the program that runs that is called sh. That's why it says starting sh. And I have a command line prompt here, so I can, for example, type ls and get a directory listing. I can use that echo command I showed earlier, and so on. Now, one thing you might say is, how do I quit this? You might try control C, you'll find out that doesn't do anything. So one option is you can type control X and then Q, or control A. Q. This is a control. I thought it was control X. Maybe I have that configured wrong. You can type shut. So one option is you can type shutdown. There's no clear command. You can type shutdown to do it. And I should post what the actual other. You can look up in the QEMU documentation what the. There's some other keyboard commands for exiting by force. But there's a shutdown command to shut down. And if you start it again, you can see just not compiling anything. Shutdown. So that's using QEMU, and we'll have more instructions in the assignment. Questions? Okay. So I talked about system calls, and because you're going to have to add a system call to XV6, we're going to go in a lot of detail on what system calls look like and how they're handled in XV6. So we're going to talk about the example of a write system call. And there's going to be a bunch of steps. So we're going to first have our user program, and we're going to have some C code which calls the write function. So we're going to make a function call to a write function. And typically, when we use system calls from C, we call a normal function, and that function is known as a system call wrapper. And that's a little piece of assembly code, and all it does is translate our C function call into a system call. And the reason it does that is because we can't actually generate a system call instruction directly from C, because it's a special instruction not used in any normal C calls. So instead, we have this wrapper function. And this wrapper function is actually going to make the system call. And we're going to have to use a special instruction that's going to trigger an exception. In XV6, they use this int instruction, because 32-bit x86 doesn't have a syscall instruction. So they use an instruction called int for interrupt that triggers an exception deliberately. And when that exception happens, there's this thing called an interrupt table. So there's an array of basically function pointers, and the hardware is going to read that array and decide, where do I go to in the OS? So the OS set up a pointer in that array at boot, so when we run the special instruction, the hardware reads that the appropriate part of that array and jumps to that location that it finds in that array. So, and it jumps, it switches stacks at that time, we'll talk about that probably next time, and runs, in the case of XV6, an assembly function called vector64. And the assembly function saves some registers in a C struct, and then calls a C function called trap. That C function called trap then calls a function called syscall, and that function called syscall uses our calling convention. So remember when I showed you in Linux, we set these registers up to say what type of system call it was. XV6 uses the same thing, so there's going to be a system call number, as we put it, in the EAX register. So in the syscall function, we're going to look at that value. We're not going to look at it directly. We're actually going to get it saved. We're going to look at where it was saved by the assembly code. And we're going to figure out, this is a write, not an exit, for example. Because we need to figure out, was it a write system call, an exit system call, a read? Figure out it's a write. And based on that, we're going to call a syswrite function, which actually implements the write operation. It's going to do the work of like displaying a value to the screen or writing it to a file. And then we're going to return from this and finally execute our return from interrupt and go back to the system call wrapper, return from that, and end up returning from the write function that the C code called. So questions on this high-level process? We have part of this in kernel, part of this. Yes? Question is, which parts run in the user mode and the kernel mode? This part shaded in purple is in user mode. The part shaded in yellow is in kernel mode. Yes?
Can you go over the kernel mode portion again?
Can I go over the kernel mode portion? I will in a lot of detail. This is the, But more general questions? So I'll start with the user mode part. And then we'll go to the kernel mode part after this. So here's, for example, some C code which calls a write function. And this is typically in Unix systems, when you want to make a system call, you'll write some C code which makes a function call. And that's just a normal function call. But instead, it's going to call an assembly function. And in XV6, there's a file usys.S, which produces assembly code, which is just what is known as system call wrappers. So for write, for example, what that does is it moves a constant, 16, into EAX to tell the operating system later on, this is the write operation, not something else. And it runs this interrupt instruction with a constant 64 to say, this is a system call triggering instruction. This interrupt instruction will trigger an exception when it is run. And the parameter helps the operating system know what kind of operation it is. You might ask, why are we using a system call number when we have this parameter here? This is a choice XP6 made and did not have to make. And you might say, that's just silly of XP6. This is also the most common choice in real operating systems, that most of them did not really take advantage of this x86 feature of giving you a number. And that's why 64-bit x86 added this syscall instruction, which doesn't take a number parameter, because no one cared about it. They just use registers to do it themselves, because that's more flexible. And the convention here is that EAX contains the system call number to tell us it's a write. You might say, what about the other arguments? Where are they? So in 32-bit x86, the calling convention is that all arguments are on the stack. So those arguments are on the stack, and the system call wrapper doesn't change that. They're still on the stack, and later on, we're going to read from the stack here, figure out where that was, and read those arguments from the kernel to figure out what's being written, where is it being written. Okay. So we have this special instruction to trigger an exception, and we have to make sure that exception goes to the right place. So in some of the boot code, we actually set up the information that the processor is going to look at to figure that out. And the first step of that is this LIDT function. So LIDT is the x86 instruction for load interrupt descriptor table. And this is a table of pointers to the code that should run when an exception happens. So at boot, we make this table and tell the processor, it's at this location, this is the table you should look in. And it's an array of pointers to handler functions. It actually has a little extra information other than the pointers, which is why we don't just set it as a, like IDT of T syscall equals whatever. Instead, we use this funny setGate function, which sets an entry in the table in the format the processor expects. So the processor has the function pointer and some extra information. But the most important part here is that we say, set the T syscall operation, that entry of the table, to point to this function, which is an array of functions that we'll see eventually points to an assembly function called vector 64. Why 64? Because T syscall is 64. There's also some other operations here, things here. So one thing here is we have this DPL user. This is so the kernel knows, yes, really, it's OK if you access this because of a deliberate int instruction. Otherwise, if we try to do an int instruction that interrupts special instruction here, it won't be callable from user mode. It will trigger a, hey, this a segmentation fault-like exception. We also have to tell the processor explicitly, really, I want this to run in kernel mode. And this is just because, for some reason, x86 has the option of not running it in kernel mode, even though you'd never want that. And we have this flag here, which is set to 1 in this case, which says, don't disable other interrupts, meaning that if a key press or something like that happens while we're handling the system call, handle the key press before finishing the system call. This is a choice XP6 makes. It makes system calls writing system calls a little more complicated because, for example, if we're like reading from the keyboard buffer, we have to make sure that that doesn't get interfered with by a key press. But it means that like a slow system call isn't going to slow other things down. Like it isn't going to stop us from responding to key presses fast. But for other exceptions, it disables it. Okay, so. But as I said, most of the purpose of this is to set up our func pointer to point to where the hardware should go when this type of exception happens. And this is the system call type of exception. And the choice we made is it jumps to vector's T syscall, which is this piece of assembly here. So vector 64. And what it does is it pushes two things on the stack and then jumps to another function, which then calls a C function. And some stuff happens in between here. And a big thing which happens in between is that we set up this trap frame argument to that function. So the assembly code is responsible for doing that. And that trap frame pointer contains the save registers. And we're going to need this later. So for example, I mentioned we set a system call number in the EAX register. Well, we're going to use EAX all over the place here because it's a register we use a lot in x86. So this assembly code is going to save the old value of EAX somewhere in this structure, struct, so we can read it later from the system call implementation. So questions? So far. So you might say this trap is a very generic name, and it is, and this is all traps. So what XV6 has chosen to do is that for every single type of exception, they have a little assembly function like this that pushes like the type of exception it is on the stack, and they all call this C function. So even though the processor decided we're going to have a separate place to start for every kind of exception, XV6 has decided, no, really, I only want to have one handler for exceptions. And they did the work to undo what the processor did and get back to one handler. This is actually a very common thing to see in operating systems, is that you know they often want one handler, so they do that. So if we look at the handler for like key presses, it's very similar. Yes?
So why have different kinds of exceptions
that all handle the same thing? So question is, why have different kinds of exceptions? So parts of the handling are the same, which is why they wanted a common function. But we are going to do things based on the type of exception we had later on in this trap function. So we do want that information. Okay. Other questions? So in the trap function, as I said, we're going to do things based on the type of exception we have. We're going to have our save registers for later. And one thing we're going to do is we're going to say, OK, if it's a system call, if the type of exception, which the assembly code is saved in this trap no field of the struct, is a system call, then we want to do the system call stuff. And the system call stuff, well, we're first going to check my proc killed. So my proc is sort of like a global variable. It tells us the currently running process. So we're going to check, is the process that's trying to make a system call, should it be dead already? Did like someone do the equivalent of control C-ing it? And if so, we exit on its behalf. Otherwise, we store the save registers in the process's data structure. And we actually run the program, the function which handles system calls. And the rest of the code in trap is for dealing with things which aren't system calls. Okay. So we have this syscall function. And the syscall function is going to retrieve the number of the system call from the EAX register, which was saved by the assembly code when the exception happened. And then it's going to look up in this table of all the types of system calls that number, so you see the lookup here, and it's going to call the function corresponding to the number and store the return value of the function in EAX, so later when we store the registers to go back to the program, it can read EAX and figure out what happened. So we have this array. This is the syntax for declaring an array of function pointers. Yes, I know it doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry, C works that way. And this syntax here is set that syscalls of number equal to value as a way of saying that in C that you probably haven't seen before because it's not especially common. So then this calls a system call function, in this case syswrite, and syswrite looks like a normal function. It takes no arguments, but it needs to retrieve the arguments. So we have these utility functions, which read them from the stack. They read them from the stack because that's where they were stored when the system call wrapper happened. So we just go all the way there and figure out where they are and read them. And then this calls the actual operation. Okay, and right. And then when this returns, it goes back to the trap function. The trap function returns. And then we have a bit of assembly code that eventually calls, here calls iRent. And that goes back to the user function and finishes. So that's where we're going to finish up today. We'll review this next time and start talking about context switches.